Joel White here, host of the Rams in White podcast. We're going to be speaking about business, property and finance, talking with industry experts, property professionals, investors, developers, entrepreneurs, and ultimately how to grow, scale and build momentum in your business. Thank you for listening. Welcome back to another episode of the Rams in White Business, Property and Finance podcast. Today, it gives me great pleasure to welcome our guest, property and business entrepreneur, Alan Harding. Alan Harding has travelled down to be with us today to talk about his business and property journey. Lots of value in there to be had. Alan's had an amazing journey, previously working in the city, got his own IT consultancy business, built up a £7 million portfolio in property, various different strategies, HMOs, buy-to-lets, new builds. So I've heard a lot of different kind of wins in there and challenges that Alan's had. So I thought it'd be great to have Alan on the podcast and talk more to us about, you know, his business journey and what's going on. So welcome to the show, Alan.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for coming. Anyway, Alan, for those who don't know who you are, do you want to give us a bit of an insight to Alan Harding?
Yeah,
businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, so these days I've got an IT consultancy, which kind of keeps the money flowing in. As you say, largely a corporate IT background going back to 1999, 2000, yeah. Which wow. Just means I'm showing my age. Yeah. And I've worked through several different places. I lived in Wiltshire, so obviously worked around places like Orange and Bristol and yeah. Kind of expanded out from where I was. Moved to the city, so I went to live in London in 2008. Worked for a top law firm, managed an IT department there, moved on to a hedge fund. Which was an interesting time to go and work for something like a hedge fund in a financial crash environment. Yeah. So it was a really interesting time, really sort of turbulent for the business, but really interesting from an IT and a tech perspective and, you know, what you can deliver when a business is in not, you know, that business was never in trouble, but obviously people are taking money out. Money's not as fluid as it was for people to be able to do stuff and expand. So It gave me a really good insight into sort of how the world works. And then since then, I've worked with clients from large engineering companies, smaller travel businesses, just to really work on now a lot of merger and acquisition IT. So when companies are coming together, we look at their systems, we look at how all of that fits together, we work out how to migrate those businesses to be one sort of entity from an IT perspective. Awesome. So that's the IT business, yeah. And then obviously the part-time hobby that seems to keep expanding and never go away is the property side of it. Okay. So like most people, started off with just standard buy-to-let. Yeah. So, and obviously 2015, pre-section 21, have a bunch of buy-to-lets in my own name. Obviously not as tax efficient as they were back then, but there's also challenges around selling them now. So just sort of sat on those. Buy-to-lets and limited companies, HMOs, as you said, just working on the new build project, which should sell out this year. Got another house next to the new build project, which we're splitting and we're going to sell off as well after a refurb. Yeah. Have an SA unit and we're just looking at buying two more SA units and potentially another HMO.
You like being busy?
Yeah, busy is probably an understatement.
Or do you like pain?
It's not pain. I'm one of those people that... If I get 5 minutes in between a project because there's a lull, I'm like, right, what's next?
You're on right, Neve.
I shouldn't be. And literally all three of the projects that are going through at the moment, I sat down in January and went, I'm not buying anything big again this year. We're not doing anything. Yeah. Da, 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 da. Middle of January, we've got two offers in. We're now in June. Those two are in legals. Yeah. We've got an offer out for something else as well. So it's just, it just all keeps coming up and you just got to keep buying them.
It's the thing is when you have that momentum and you've got that experience and capital behind you and know-how, it seems, even though there could be challenges along the way, it just seems like them opportunities are too great to not do, you know? So it's like adding value always. And that kind of natural entrepreneurial flair is like, how do you move forward and progress? Yeah. It's kind of a bit of a bug, right?
Yeah, it is. It is. And you sit there and you tell yourself, oh, I'm going to have a quiet year. I'm just going to sit back. We're going to let everything we've done in the last 5 years kind of take effect. We'll just level it off. We'll see what happens. Yeah, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Just keep going.
So let's just jump back a little bit to the city life, because I'm really intrigued with like the city and, you know, the kind of high pressure that comes of that and a certain type of person it takes to be successful in that environment. So what kind of attracted you to working in the city and in that environment?
Yeah, so when I went initially, obviously I'd been working in Bristol, and the initial driver at the time, I'd had a relationship that broken up.
Yeah.
I wasn't unhappy in my job, but I wanted something different. I wanted a new challenge. And from an IT perspective, me looking from the outside, I was like, the easiest place to go and get a challenge is London.
Yeah.
So you're moving a different gear. You're moving from kind of small city, everybody's really friendly, kind of, it's more of a family vibe,
yeah,
to a city where it's structured, where it's very formal, everybody's still in suits back then, you know. So it was that kind of step up, that challenge, that kind of, if you really want to take your career somewhere, you're going to have to go and do that stint. But yeah, so it does take a certain person. I mean, I went straight in to manage an IT department in a law firm.
Yeah.
You know, it's an international law firm. And going from something that you're only dealing really with UK and a small part of Europe to suddenly dealing with from Hong Kong through to the North America markets from a law firm perspective was very different.
Yeah.
So you very quickly learn you have to adapt, you have to be able to like deal with those people, you have to be able to cross time zones. Yeah. You know, it's a whole new bunch of challenges that come with it, really.
Yeah, like they're kind of the kind of pursuit of excellence in them kind of businesses from every angle. You kind of really got to step up and deliver, I guess, or they expect you to deliver.
Yeah.
And that's why probably they paid very well in that, in them environments. So you've got your, so were you kind of working for the firm or did you have your IT consultancy firm then?
No. So back then, I mean, I was a self-employed contractor back then,
yeah,
but it was just directly to one place. So the law firm and the hedge fund, just literally directly to them, working for them all the time.
What did you prefer, the law firm or the hedge firm?
Hedge fund. Yeah, without doubt. I think the law firm was so rigid and so structured that you kind of, I don't know, you're working within a framework where IT doesn't always stick to a kind of logical framework, if you like. So you have to be able to step outside of that. But yeah, you know, it's just random things like, you know, dress down Friday was you're allowed to take your tie off.
Wow.
That was the level of what dress down was. But then equally it was sort of balanced in the summer in London when it gets too hot. Mm. You could go in shorts and shirt as long as you had a suit by your desk to wear if somebody came in that you had to see, things like that. So it was balanced. But yeah, it was very, very structured. Mm. And I never forget at the time, you know, you'd write IT documentation. My boss would review it. Yeah. I'm thinking I'm 25, 26 at the time, and he would print it off and literally sit with you across his desk with a red pen. Oh, and I just like, okay, this is a bit different. I'm just used to like an email review of somebody going, oh, can you just change this? Can you look at this? You might have made a spelling mistake here. No, this is like proper underlining, circling your grammar mistakes. And I was like, oh, it's like being back at school. Yeah, but it was that detailed. It was that sort of real structured place to be.
I guess it's a good experience to kind of have that discipline in your own business, you know, and when other clients you're dealing with now, you can kind of take that lessons and take it forward of your own style.
Yeah, you do learn a lot.
Yeah. Okay, so why property then? So obviously you've got a successful business, you know, you've got some great clients that you're working with, great reputation, which you've worked hard to build over many years. What attracted you to property as an investment?
Yeah, so it all goes back in the, I was 18 in 2000. And so late 90s, early 2000s, I was working. Mm. I was starting to look at what was going on in the world. I never went to university, so I did a lot of reading. And I started to understand, you know, even back then, you look at things like the government pension deficits.
Yeah.
And you could see then the population is growing older. Mm. There are less people working, so there are less people paying tax into a system that's trying to support an aging population. So from a NHS healthcare perspective, they're living longer, they need more treatment, that comes at a cost. They're living longer, we're putting their pensions up to meet inflation, that comes at a cost.
Yeah.
But there is a deficit in that. Mm. And one of the things I sort of worked out really early on in that kind of piece when I was younger is that, and I still believe the state pension won't exist by the time I get to that retirement age, which I now think is something like 72.
Yeah.
So I've got another 33 years. Yeah. I genuinely don't believe there'll be something like the state pension. I think we'll be broke.
Yeah. It's hard to like even factor in that state pension into your
retirement. Yeah, you just can't. So back then I was like, how do I make sure I can look after myself in retirement?
The Ramsey & White podcast is proudly sponsored by TFG Capital, a non-regulated short-term finance lender able to deal with intermediaries, landlords, investors and developers across the UK. With a strong appetite to lend and the ability to fund bridging loans within a matter of days, TFG will find a lending solution that's exactly tailored to the client's requirements for either investment purchase, refinances, release of equity, or refurbishments. With hands-on senior leadership team deeply experienced in real estate finance, they can offer a unique service to take on challenges other lenders often can't. Lending decisions are based on the security and not the serviceability, financial performance, or credit reports. If you're looking for business-related cash flow to refinance or add to your property portfolio or require funding for your next development and would like to find out more, feel free to contact the team today on 0800 061 4834 or email sales@tfgcapital.co.uk.
And again, a lot of the reading, everything pointed towards, you know, yes, you can buy shares, but you need to sit on them for a long time. You know, you've then got to look at Warren Buffett. It's years, it's decades. It's not, you're not going to get rich quick.
Yeah.
Property, again, it was never a get rich quick scheme, but I could see, you know, from when you buy a property and rent it out, you've got that reoccurring monthly income straight away. Mm-hmm. Property over 20, 30, 40 years is also going to go up significantly in value. So when you then come to sell it later, you've also got that bigger lump sum that's going to come back that you could do something with, you could invest it somewhere else, you could divide it up and live off of it for 10 years maybe. So it was always just that future thought of when I get to 60, I want to be able to live for another 30, 40 years and enjoy what I'm doing. I want my nice holidays. I want to be able to go and do everything.
Yeah.
So it's got, the money's got to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
And that's what drove me really into the property side.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And what, after like going through that thought process, what's been like your, what was one of your biggest challenges, I guess, when you first got into property?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing was actually knowing how to do it properly and on scale. I mean, back pre, you're talking pre-2008, I mean, money was abundant. Like you could pretty much get a mortgage on anything.
Yeah.
I wish I'd taken better advantage of that. But at the time, I bought my first house that I actually moved into. Mm-hmm. I then moved into another house in 2006 and kept that that first house. And it's rented out. And I've still got it today.
Yeah.
I think the thing from there is, because I bought my second house, loved Northern Rock, 125% mortgage. I just then kind of stopped and paused. I should have kept buying.
Yeah.
And I think that was the biggest challenge. It was just not knowing. I mean, nobody could have predicted what was going to happen 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
Well, I say nobody. Some people did.
The world was on their side.
The world didn't notice, yeah. So it's just that thing of actually having the money to keep going quick enough to be able to build it up back then.
Yeah.
I think if people built portfolios, you know, 2000 to 2008, they're probably in a really good place because they should have made a lot of money.
Yeah. It's that like momentum investing.
Yeah.
I think those products, like you said, 100%, 125%. With the right know-how and bought in the right location, you could have taken advantage of it.
Yeah.
Where some people maybe bought in the wrong location, spent money on cars and holidays with with the debt and it wasn't affordable.
Yeah, absolutely.
That caused all sorts of problems. All right, fine. So it was more like just getting the knowledge, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just, and I think back then, you know, it's before social media.
Yeah.
So didn't have all this stuff that's in front of us today. Yeah. YouTube didn't
Facebook
exist.
Lives and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, none of that existed. Yeah. So, you know, the internet was still really in its infancy. So you are just reading books, magazines, newspapers, still trying to pick up information, trying to work out what's going on.
Yeah, trying to piece the puzzle together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also
to like mitigate risk as well, being in the city.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be involved in this investment, but how I know it will work somehow, but how do I reduce that risk of loss,
I guess,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And like you said, now YouTube is just, you know, we've got the young guns in the office, they're buying first buy to lets and they come in with so much knowledge already.
Yeah.
It's like, wow.
Yeah. I mean, if you wanted to start now, I mean, you have got to ignore some of the YouTube content because I think some of it's incorrect and there's some people out there that aren't helpful with their content. But if you can find the right content, it's at your fingertips and you can learn. Back then, what would have taken a couple of years to work out, piece together, learn how you go through, you can learn it within the space of a few weeks.
Yeah, I think there's that thing when someone gives you some advice and they always just go and stress test that or go and do your due diligence on that person or, you know, go and ask someone else who's done it and say, look, I've been advised this, what's your thoughts? You know, just to stress test it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so how do you overcome challenges when dealing with builders, tenants, solicitors, brokers, that whole power team?
Should we start with the broker?
Yeah. Welcome to Ramsey. Is it just like you don't know what you don't know? Or like how, you know, in the early days when you're coming into this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of lessons I've learned over all the projects I've done. I think one of the things, so let's start with the legal process when you're buying a property and solicitors. Mm. I think the thing is, they will never move at the speed you expect them to.
Yeah.
At all. Yeah. Doesn't matter what you do, try and put a rocket under them. The biggest challenge is going to be they just won't move at the speed you're expecting them to, and everything will take longer.
Yeah.
You need to find a really good solicitor. I've been recommended a couple. And it does partly come back to you get what you pay for. So if you want to pay £600 for a solicitor to sit and do it, well, you're not going to be the top of their list because they've got 30 cases they're looking at and they'll tick a box on each case every day and move it along a very small amount. Mm-hmm. If you want somebody to deal with it in 28 days, you're likely going to be paying $7,000 to $10,000 in fees because that's the only thing they're going to be working on.
Yeah.
So there is a balance. I mean, I again, trial and error, but I've been through a few solicitors and you have your struggles with them. And when you get to a point, some of them have been good for a while and then they sort of go off the boil. So you leave them and walk away.
Yeah.
And I've now stuck with the same solicitor for about 4 years. Mm-hmm. But it's also just that there's that kind of trust and knowledge element. So he knows what my expectations are now. And he'll just pick the phone up and go, this is where we are. This is what's going on. I can't do any more until the other solicitor gets back to me. Great. That's all I need to know because I'm now not chasing you.
Yeah.
Going, I haven't heard anything. What's going on? I'm being chased by the agent or the vendor or, you know, it's all being dealt with. So I guess that's the thing is like you will go through and it's the same with everything. Builders, letting agents, brokers, you'll go through a few until you find somebody that you're happy with.
Yeah.
And it does come down to service. And like I say, you also tend to get cycles with all of those people.
Yeah.
They're good for a while. Mm-hmm. And then something will happen and it could be a life event. It could be something else that changes. But then they'll drop off for a bit. And you're like, "Now, come on, you've been really good."
Yeah, yeah.
But that's, you kind of then, you'll go and find somebody else.
Yeah, no, it's good to hear. And I think, so communication's key, right?
Yeah.
So knowledge, communication, and just get that proactiveness. We like try and build a team at Ramsey and White where you've got your advisors, you've got your team around you that can kind of be proactive in that moment. And I think from being an investor myself, it's, you know, when you're chasing solicitors or brokers or whoever it may be, lenders, it's just, you just want them to say, if there's no news, just let me know. So I can keep the vendor's expectations or the estate agent's expectations and go, look, we are working on it. This is what they said to me, which is nothing, but at least I'm keeping you in the loop.
Yeah.
And then that kind of reduces the risk of, losing a deal because I feel like time kills deals, right?
So. Yeah, absolutely. The longer it drags on, the more temptation there is or the more kind of emphasis there is for somebody to walk away.
Yeah, especially like in a rising market. I had it when I was buying a property and the legals are just being dragged out and it's going on months and months and nothing was getting moved. I went down to their office and I said, oh, we're waiting for this and that. And the estate agents were just constantly contacting the vendor. We can get you another $10,000. We can get you another $20,000. And it was like, then that was kind of back to me. I'm like, look, I'm trying. You know, that these things happen, don't they? But so you kind of really need to have a team that can kind of push.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay, cool. So what advice would you give to someone who's looking to invest in property for the first time? Don't do it.
But know what you're doing first. Don't just rush out and buy the first thing you find. Don't live in the south and think you can buy 10 properties up north and deal with it sensibly. Don't buy an absolute crap hole and expect to make money on it the first time. I think you need to seriously understand what are you trying to get out of the first one. Is it a learning experience because you want to do more?
Yeah.
Or do you just want to buy it for the cash flow?
Yeah.
And you really need to determine where you want to go. Seek somebody out, like we've said, that you can ask advice of as you go through that process.
Yeah.
And ask for recommendations for solicitors, for brokers, for everything. Because recommendations come higher. If somebody's used them, they trust them, you're going to get a better experience than trying to go for your first one and find everybody yourself.
Yeah. We've seen so many deals happen over the years and we always say there's like two types of people. There's people that are just eager to get into the deal.
Yeah.
And will just find a deal and just barrel their way through into it and end up either failing or just making loads of mistakes but having to rectify them really quickly to make the deal work. Or those who don't do a deal for a very long time, but they're doing so much due diligence and getting the right people around them. And then once they get into a deal, it's just like plain sailing because they built that team and knowledge around them and they just smooth into it. And there is actually a third person that just doesn't do anything. They kind of just analyze and sit on things.
Look at it and then it's too late.
You know, I've still got clients. I say not clients, but people I'm speaking to from like 12 months ago. And they just once a month call me, we have a chat. And I'm like, I'm happy to do that. But I'm like, you've got to take, you've You could probably write a book on the knowledge you've got, you've built up. But so it is that action, taking action, but getting on the right people.
Yeah, there's always, there's, you know, loads of people will give you different statements. And I think Barack Obama is a famous one. It's like, you'll never have 100% of the knowledge you need to move forward. But if you've got 51% and that's enough for you to make a decision, do it.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great statement.
Yeah.
I think I heard you say that before, actually, the 51%. Because it's actually, well, 51%, let's go for it. Let's make it happen. What's the worst that can happen?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. It's more than the downside.
Yeah.
So you've built up portfolio.
Yeah.
7 million plus.
Yeah.
What's next for the, like, is there more property to come? What we were talking about briefly then, like, what's the end goal with the property business?
Yeah, so,
or is there one? It's hard. I ask myself.
It is hard. Yeah. If I were to go back probably 4 or 5 years to when I really started pushing it, the end goal was to get rich.
Yeah.
Right. And that was just, I think, you know, early 30s, you're coming up, you just go, I just want a load of money.
Yeah.
You don't really think much past that. But as I got into it and we started developing through those properties, that very quickly changed. It was like, actually, the goal went back to, I want to retire wealthy.
Yeah.
Or retire in a place where we can afford a nice house. We can still have a new car. We can still go on 3-4 holidays a year without feeling uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And then that changed again. And it was like, no, I want to retire early.
Yeah.
Okay, what age do you want to retire at? Well, I'm going to retire at 40.
Yeah.
And that's not do nothing. That's just step away from maybe the consultancy, wind the hours back, not work as hard and actually spend more of that time traveling.
Yeah.
And that is where it still is, really. So it's really come back to, I want enough money to sustain our life now whilst carrying on investing, and then step away from like having to work so many hours.
Mm. You get to a point where the experiences of life become more meaningful doing that on your own terms, like you mentioned traveling.
Yeah.
I definitely feel an element of that. Like, I went on holiday recently and it's like, I'm just going down, I'm in Greece and I'm on a moped going down the road, and it just, it felt like freedom, right?
Yeah.
And I'll never not want to be in business or building my portfolio, but having that choice to go off and do that and live a little and feel free, that's great, right? Having choices to do that.
But like you've got Ramsden White, you've got this, you've got several businesses attached to that.
Yeah.
And sometimes you do get to a point, and like you're saying, you know, you get to stress points in your life where you just go, actually, it's quite a ball and chain at the moment. Mm. And I need to step back from it. How do I get out of this? At the moment, we go on holiday.
Yeah.
But how do you kind of, what's next?
Yeah.
Where do you go with it?
So obviously with your portfolio, you could step away from work. Yeah. But, and if you kept on building that portfolio, you know, you replace your income from the business. Could you see yourself never having the business and being just, like, full-time property with nothing to do? I'd say nothing, but there'd always be something.
There's always something to do.
But it's very, like,
different. I think, like, in my head, probably by, I don't know, maybe next year. So we've got these three projects coming in, which should add the money I want to meet our monthly goals. And that's what I'm saying. Like, it has to sustain our life.
Yeah.
But there also has to be enough money that we can carry on investing without necessarily needing outside investment as well.
Yeah.
So it's not just covering a wage. It's a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
But there will come a point where, you know, I'd quite happily probably just pick up one project a year, run it through, and then spend the rest of the year on holiday.
Yeah.
You know, because when you look at it, realistically, if you pick up a project, by the time you put the offer in, it gets accepted. You get it through legals, 12 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to refurb it, 12 weeks, realistically, by the time the builder's free, they get on site, depending what it is, could be longer than that, could be 6 months. If you're either selling it, letting it, refinance, doing something else with it, you know, you're 12 weeks. Months for a project.
Yeah.
So if you've just got one ongoing, it's not too bad. Yeah. And you can, you know, if you've got the right people in place, you can be anywhere to keep on top of it and keep it managed.
Yeah, so you're kind of like enjoying yourself, enjoying your life, but your business is good. You've still got purpose, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Go meet people for lunch, go for coffee, go to the gym.
They say you can get bored in retirement, but I think if you put it like that, you are still working, and you're working around your business rather than it's attention.
It'll never be doing nothing. I'd be bored within 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I genuinely, like, this next week is going to be a bit of a challenge, because I know by probably Monday lunchtime, I'll be twitchy going, need something to do.
Well, I had, like, Dean, one of the partners at Ramsden White, he was in Dubai with his family. He was there for 10 days. And by day 6, he's like, I want to come home.
Yeah.
I thought, you're in Dubai with your family and what, you can still work. He's like, I just want to be. was getting twitchy. He wanted to be back. Yeah. He's got his own portfolio he's building, etc. So that's just that desire to keep moving forward.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, not everybody gets it. No. You know, even my other half, we have conversations about this, and it's like stop, and I'm like, no, there's something else coming. We've got to go.
Yeah.
And it is difficult.
Opportunity.
Yeah.
How's the balance between you and your other half in terms of work life? Are you obviously pushing a portfolio, pushing the business?
Yeah.
Is it kind of like, right, well, when I come back, I just switch off for an hour? Or how do you kind of manage that?
Because
you've got a plan, maybe there's an end goal there.
Yeah, there's a bit of a plan. The work-life balance, both of us, is challenging. I mean, Chris has got his own business, which is really successful anyway.
Yeah.
So the hours we actually get together at the moment are limited.
Yeah.
But again, it comes down to a bit of organisation, and we block, you know, large chunks of the weekend just to sort of do nothing or be around the house together so that we get that time together. Because I get up early, sort dogs out, Chris will go to work, you know, we're in and out all day between us, and then he doesn't get home till late.
Yeah.
So, and then like I'm half asleep because I need to get up at 4:45 the next morning to take the dogs back out. So it's like just this cycle. So the balance, I would say at the moment for both of us, the balance is swung quite heavily on the work side.
Yeah.
But that's just because, you know, in our own right, both of what we're doing is really successful. Mm. There will come a point where that does need to swing back. And that's, for me, is slowing down the building of the portfolio and walking away from the consultancy. So it's just getting to that point where, and I think it's confidence, it's fear, it's anxiety about what is next. If I step away from this thing that's brought me money for 20 years, what happens next?
Yeah.
Like, what does happen next? I know I've built something that should be able to sustain it, but there is still just that little fear element of, if I just stop tomorrow, what actually happens?
Yeah, is that like, who am I as well?
Yeah.
Like, I am Ramsay and White in terms of like built this company.
Yeah.
If I was doing it for 20 years and then I was stepping away, I'd be like, you'd be elated because of, you might have achieved something, sold, got an exit. But then at the same time, what do you do?
Yeah. And especially,
like,
you know,
150 emails. Why is no one emailing me?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're a bit younger than me as well. But I'm sat here looking at it going, I'm not even halfway through my life.
Yeah.
What does that look like then if I suddenly walked away from it?
Yeah. On the flip side, it's amazing to think that you can be in a position to do that, right?
So
I want to speak to you about diary management.
Yeah.
You are militant when it comes to diary management.
I try to be.
And I want to just learn. Like, the good thing about this podcast, I learn quite a lot as well. Yeah. I know the viewers take a lot. But we was at a mastermind recently, and I walked to the back of the room just to stretch my legs, and we were listening to someone speak, and it was really informative and great. And you were sending some emails, and, you know, I wasn't prime, but as I stood past you, I just seen your diary, and it was just like all these different colours and that, and I was like, oh, well, I need to get my together with my diary, and I said, like, I need to speak to Alan about that. So I heard you speaking about block diary management. Do you want to talk to us a bit about that, and like when you started that and how that has made an impact in your life?
Yeah, absolutely. So it all goes back to Rob Moore when I first met him in 2016 and started mentoring with him to start building the portfolio fully. And he was very adamant about, you have to manage your time properly. And I really noticed, and I think everybody will tell you, if you've got white space in your diary, you procrastinate. Yeah. That's when you scroll through social media. That's when you start, like, you'll go and make a cup of coffee, you'll have a chat, you'll do something else. So everybody's great at making a to-do list, but nobody's great at like prioritizing it and actually following them through. So you'll end up with loads of to-do lists and nobody actually really does them.
Yeah.
And what the idea is basically your entire life needs to go into your diary. Now, everybody walks around with a phone, with a device, it syncs to your laptop, syncs to your iPad, syncs across everything you're looking at all the time.
Yeah.
So every single thing you need to do needs to be in your diary and needs to have a time slot. Everything. So like you know, I literally have blocks of sleep. I have blocks when we watch TV. I have blocks when I cook dinner.
Yeah.
I have blocks for, you know, yoga, going to the gym, for walking the dogs, everything. Like, if you look for tomorrow, because I was trying to plan what I need to do before I go away on Sunday, I literally have shower, need to go and buy chicken food, need to do this.
Yeah.
I need to send some accounts emails to get that finished off before I go away.
Yeah.
Like, even Saturday is completely blocked out from like 6 a.m. till 4 p.m.
Yeah.
And then after that, that's my time. Yeah. I can do what I want then because I've done everything.
Yeah.
Now,
it must be like such a sense of achievement as well by the end of the day.
It's an achievement, right? It stresses Chris out no end because he's just completely the opposite. But I will spend 20 minutes on a Sunday and I can tell you what I'm doing for the entire week.
Wow.
Everything. Like, yeah. Everything is blocked in. Mm. I hate people that then try and change appointments because I'm just like, nope, I've booked my entire week. You now need to go to next week. Yeah. You're messing me about. And it's not saying everything will always get done at that time.
Yeah.
I do move stuff because life comes up, right? Yeah. Something will change, something will happen, and you'll need to move things around. But I tend to find if you've got it in there, you're more likely to do it.
Yeah.
My phone pops up and tells me what I'm doing in 15 minutes and I can just go, yeah, I've got to do that.
Yeah.
And you just follow it through. And it takes a bit of practice and a bit of getting used to it at the beginning. Mm. But psychologically in the week, you can switch off because I literally just go, yeah, I've got to do that.
So if you're training, it's in the diary, I'm going for a run or walking the dogs or having dinner. It's
Going to the gym is in there. If I'm then going for a run separately, that's in there. Yeah, making dinner, walking the dogs, everything.
So that brain, that time on a Sunday, 20 minutes, does that allow you to have more brain space then in the week to, you know it's there and you roll into the task?
It actually, for me, it reduces a lot of anxiety going into a Monday morning not knowing what's happening as well. And just because, obviously, we work with a couple of clients, we've got the property stuff, you know, you have to understand like where things are happening in your week. So it really does become things like social media time to stop you scrolling, block half an hour and just spend half an hour doing it.
Yeah.
If you need to put posts out, block 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes in the evening and make sure they're all done or schedule them.
Yeah, because if you look at your, phone time? Is it screen time? That can be quite scary sometimes, can't it? Like, where's that time gone?
You know? I mean, exactly. When you start looking, I think beginning of the year, mine was about 3 hours a day. And you think, what am I doing for 3 hours a day?
Yeah.
Admittedly, like, I will reply to emails when I'm walking the dog and stuff like that. So all that counts. But yeah, I've gone back and set time limits on a lot of my apps. So after 30 minutes, a lot of them lock out on the iPhone.
Nice.
And then you can get back into them, obviously. Yeah. But it's trying to get in a habit of going, well, I've used my allocation for today. Let's not do it. But the diary on the Sunday of spending 20 minutes just looking at it on an iPad, like the rest of that Sunday, I'm really clear. Like, I don't feel like I've got any pressures walking into the week because I know what's happening. I know what I've got to do and I know what I'm expecting of myself.
Yeah, I think it's that discipline then can roll into other areas of your life, like your business, property, and ultimately hitting your goals, right?
Yeah. So
it's awesome.
Yeah.
In terms of your PA.
Yeah.
VA or PA?
PA.
PA.
Well, she's not sat at a desk next to me, but she's in the UK, so I don't go abroad for it.
Yes. Okay. How does she see the diary as well? And then, or does she send her tasks and how does that work?
Yeah, she does see the diary. But a lot more of that is that I just list out tasks for her to do. Because diary's more around what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So for her, I just put a task list together and I'll sit down and just go, you need to do this. You know, you need to make sure Zero's up to date. You need to reply to this email for me. You need to do this.
And how has that been for you in your kind of working life and personal life? It gives you more time because I'm in that space that people saying you need a PA. I dabbled with it and then I'm like, some people are like, when you have one, then you will never go back. But
I've really enjoyed it. It has taken a massive amount of stress out of my life. So it's somebody that I'd known for years before I actually employed her as my assistant. So she knows me, which was for me was really beneficial because I didn't have to go through that whole kind of personal bonding piece with somebody. I mean, they are close to you. It's things like, you know, she's got full access to all the accounts, to all my emails, can see my entire life right in front of her.
Yeah.
So you do have to have a lot of trust in them. But then equally, because she knows who I am and the way I like things done, it's things like I can just go, these are the dates. I need 2 flights. I need a hotel. I need car hire to this place.
Nice.
Come back with it. And she'll just go, right, you've got this, and this is price. And I'm like, yeah, just book it. Happy. You know? Yeah. So that I don't have to think about it. It is. It's massive.
Yeah. For me, I'm kind of in and out of London so much. I'm like, oh, when am I getting the train? Am I driving? Where am I parking? Covent Garden?
Yeah.
Time zone, all that sort of stuff. So that's really helpful, actually.
Yeah. I do all of that. I'm like, I need train tickets.
Yeah.
These are my preferred times. Just get me train tickets.
Yeah.
And literally, she's got access to like my Trainline account. Mm. So then they just appear in the app on my phone. Yeah. I haven't got to think about it.
Yeah, another founder told me that his PA, he's like literally watching his diary move around, and he said she's finding ways to make his life more efficient,
yeah,
better than he can. And yeah, he's that. I hope he's sharing that with me. So.
But a good PA will.
Yeah,
they will make your life better.
Yeah, I need the PA.
Yeah, yeah, you do.
Joel, go to sleep.
But it's little things like you won't think about. You're coming back off holiday.
Yeah,
they'll have done a food order that will arrive just after you get back off holiday. So there's food at the house. Like, do you know what I mean? It's little things like that, because otherwise you're getting off an aeroplane, and the car that your PA has organised is picking you up, but then you're getting home and going, oh, I've got no food in the house, got to sort this out. What do you do? But actually, if you can get them to help with everything,
the every day, which you shouldn't,
it's incredible,
and so you can just focus on the better things, the bigger tasks, etc.
Right,
online presence. So you've got the podcast, more than just property,
More than just property.
Check it out, guys. It's a great podcast, some really good guests on there, including myself.
I was gonna say, check out episode 2 specifically. Yeah. I think it's 2.
Yeah, gonna hear about the journey. It looks great. There's some fantastic guests on there. Well done. Why did you set up the podcast? What's behind the name? Do you want to let guys know about that?
Yeah, so the biggest reason for the podcast is to help me in my own education. Mm-hmm. And that was about getting out and finding people that could help me, that would want to sit down and have a conversation like this. Yeah. Like, you know, the conversation with yourself around your journey and where you've come from and what you're doing is really good. And like, you know, these conversations talking about diary management, talking about something that you're really good at that I might not have picked up on actually really helps me.
Yeah.
So number one, it's about me learning for myself. The second piece is to try and get information out there to help people. I think the world's in a crazy place where, you know, costs are rising. People haven't got as much money as they once had. Everybody's got a phone. Podcasts are free. Mm-hmm. So people can get educated without spending any money on something they might be interested in the future. And I think it's really important for people to start understanding that they don't necessarily need a lot of money to improve their lives. I think people look at it from an outside that, you know, you need to be rich to start, and you don't.
Yeah.
But I think, just to help educate people in business, in ways of life, in how they can make their own lives better without, you know, necessarily impacting what they do day to day now.
Yeah. No, I think
it's just those lessons.
Really important. And like you said, it's completely free, and it's there's definitely more people moving towards that kind of podcast content to digest information. I remember when we set up the Rams White podcast was to, you know, give content back to our existing clients and then try and reach more clients.
Yeah.
But actually what I found is I started learning loads from investors, business owners, and took a lot away from it for my own kind of personal journey as well. I remember speaking to someone who built up a very successful business and portfolio, and he was telling me about how he raised money and the conversations he had with some of his investors. And it was simple as, you know, just asking for it, you know, just saying. And I remember being with the mortgage business, I was so professional in that I'd never think of asking someone else for money. Like, and we still don't, our clients. But then when I put my hat on as an investor in another business, I switched into that mode and had a really good conversation. And then we raised some capital, did an investment, and worked really well. And he gave us some good feedback through a SaaS fund. So it was, I learned that from having that conversation through the podcast. So
it
works both ways, which is awesome.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So what's the plan with it? One a week, two, once a month?
So it's once a fortnight at the moment. And that largely was just around timing and getting recordings done. Like, it's been a bit of a crazy year this year, but I was really keen to get it out as well, so that it was out there. So it's once a fortnight, hoping within probably Q3 or Q4 this year we'll move that up to once a week, if not twice a week.
Oh wow.
So I want to bring it forward and really, really focus on getting some episodes out there.
Awesome. We'll look forward to hearing your essays. Check it out guys, more than just property with Alan Harden.
Thank you.
Property market, any concerns with the future market, how it's going to look? Like, you know, landlords have had a bashing over the last, well, they've always seemed to have a bashing, don't they?
Yeah, constantly.
with tax and all this stuff. And, you know, so what we're looking at now is interest rate rises potentially. Yeah. What's your kind of views on or concerns around, if any, around the market?
Yeah, I think my concerns more are that I think the market's overinflated. I think prices are way above what they should be. You know, 2 years ago, we went into a global pandemic and the world stopped and house prices went through the roof.
Yeah.
And how that's even logical just to anybody doesn't make sense.
Well, double-digit growth all around the world, wasn't
it? Yeah, absolutely. And you think, hang on a minute, the world is not moving. Yeah. But when you look at how the government's propped everybody up, it kind of does fall into line and make a bit of sense. But I think some of that's going to get undone. I mean, I think Halifax said, you know, the other day, with house prices rising, you know, something like record growth again last month because people are paying the over the odds for it somewhere to lock in a cheaper interest rate all of a sudden. I think, you know, we've had cheap money for a very long time. So what, 2008, 2009, interest rates have hit the lowest they've ever been. They've stayed there. Having had houses and mortgages pre-2008, you know, I think my first interest rate on my own purchase, on my own resi mortgage, was probably 4.5%, 5%, if not more. So I kind of think some of that needs to come back into the market to cool it down a little bit. I think it is way over the top. But apart from that, I'd sit here and say in 12 months, I think prices will be lower than what they are now. Are we going to see a full-on crash? No. There's too much money available in the world for that to happen. You've only got to read the articles around, you know, during lockdown and COVID, people saved more than they ever have done before. They reckon there's billions sat in bank accounts that people are ready to spend, but they've got nowhere to spend it at the moment. So it's a difficult balance. I mean, interest rates will keep going up, and you know, don't be surprised if mortgage rates hit 4-5% for standard, not 1.2 or 1%.
Well, I was in a meeting last Friday, in this breakfast meeting, and there was an economist in there, and, like, you know, they like to make the predictions, but they were saying that they feel over the next 12 months the Bank of England base rate will go to 3.25%. Which obviously the lenders will follow suit, and that means the cost of borrowing is going to be a lot more expensive. So that'll definitely slow things down. I guess it's just how your business is built, isn't it? How robust you are, how liquid you are. And as entrepreneurs or investors, the opportunity is there as well. You know, so how can we use our knowledge and finance to take advantage of them opportunities and ultimately to add value, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is. I think people just need to kind of be prepared that, you know, yes, mortgage lenders have stress tested at a certain level. I don't think we'll get there because that was like 5.5-6%. But I think, you know, if interest rates keep going up, you will see people starting to get into trouble.
I think Norman Lamont, I think, was the Chancellor of the Exchequer in London 80s.
I was going to say, now you're going back on Major's Day. So this is like late 80s, so early 90s.
4-5%. Right there, it's like 14%.
Yeah, so 14-15% 1992.
House was a lot cheaper back then, and wages different, sort of all relative. But I mean, 14% for mortgages. I think we have had... you know, I think a lot of investors, especially new investors coming into the market, would feel that, you know, 2%, 2.5% is the norm, which it has been for a long time. But quickly, it's a moving. I mean, the problem we've got as a brokerage at the moment, say if yourself, Alan, wanted to do a mortgage today. And we're getting the documents and preparing the case. Literally, by the end of the day, the rates could have changed. So the lenders are like, you need to get this deal in by 5 o'clock because we are putting our rates up, and it's like that every day. And I think that's one of the biggest struggles we're facing at the moment as a brokerage, because lenders are just jumping on a bandwagon. But again, it's just like educating and informing people, this is what's happening, you know. Be prepared, move with the times, and make sure you're built in a way that's robust to handle that.
Absolutely. And I guess a question for you on that with brokerage, I think it's this week the Bank of England have announced, is it the stress test or the affordability checks aren't going to be as stringent going forwards?
Well, so you know where they've got the, they're doing the multiplier still on, so like some lenders will be like 4 times, 5 times, 4.5 times like average. And what they would normally do as well is look at committed expenditure. So credit cards, loans, and that as well. So they factor that into the affordability. And what they were saying is you don't need to do that as a lender, but you would still need to do the multiplier. But so it's been put in the news like that, and then everyone's thinking, oh, that's, you know, that's dangerous. What's that mean? But they've also said, well, it's up to the bank to do it, or the lender to do it. So the lender could say, well, we're still going to stress test it because of our funding lines, and we don't want to lend irresponsibly. But if you give someone that carrot and they go, well, we've got a little bit more money to lend,
exactly.
You know, let's just ignore this 100 grand or 200 grand over there. And
I was going to say, there's going to be somebody who's going to be sat looking at it going, actually, we can make some money. It won't become the norm again, but
it's interesting.
It was.
Watch your space.
No, but thanks for the explanation, because I was looking at it going, does that mean I can just walk out and get shit loads of money?
Yeah. Self-cert.
Yeah. That'll never come back,
hopefully. No, absolutely not. And I think, you know, we wouldn't want it to. So, I mean, we've sent out a few emails to lenders when we heard the press release, and we're waiting a bit on a bit of feedback. And I think it's like during COVID, no one knew what was going on. It's like, okay, this is kind of the news, come from government. What can happen? How do we respond internally? Yeah. So there'll be a few more changes. I think for us, it's, again, that communication, speaking to lenders, informing our clients what's going on, but also being available for the other opportunities, you know, in the wealth management, the accountancy, the estate agency, and just making sure our clients are getting that info as well to best perform in their business, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
I spoke to an FD once, and he said he'd been in business 35 years, and he said for the first 10 years, I only spent 20% of the income that I made.
Yeah.
So for 10 years, 80% of his income from what it generated, he just saved in the business. So he said to me, I don't care if there's a recession, depression, whatever's going on, I have got so much money in the bank, I'm good and invested. And I thought, you know, fair play, because he had that discipline on the front end. So now on the back end, he's well capitalized to take advantage of the opportunity in the market, keep his company going.
Yeah.
He's brought in partners. And I thought that was really good, because you do see people who have a few quick wins and then think that's going to last forever.
Yeah.
But it's not always the case, is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I think we can learn a lot from 2007, 2008, not just on the markets, but how people operated.
Yeah.
Cool. Mentorship. You mentioned Rob from Progressive Property. Have you had any, including Rob, any other mentors, and what's like the best advice they've given you that you would take away?
I mean, I think when you're in a corporate environment, you know, senior managers and people above you are always kind of there as mentors as well to help you through your career. When you step out and you're in business on your own, it becomes a bit different, and you have to go looking for them a bit more because they're not just readily on hand. I mean, Rob and Mark were both really great during the mentorship I had with them.
Yeah.
Following that, I haven't had direct mentorship with anybody else.
Yeah.
Mainly just because I've got to the point where, for what I'm doing, I have enough knowledge to be able to keep taking that forward myself.
Yeah.
It's only when I come to look at something that I don't understand, I go back and try and find somebody to help me that's already done it. Mm. I think it's important for everybody to be able to reach out to people, whether it's in mentorship, whether it's in a different way, whether it's through the mastermind groups like we're part of, to try and help get that experience if they're doing something they're unsure of. Mm. So, you know, there's a lot of information out there about, you know, you can start and do it yourself and you're going to learn. You're probably going to fail, or if you do fail, you'll learn a lot more. But just taking some of that failure out by speaking to somebody who's been there, who's done it, who can give you some advice is more than beneficial, I think.
Yeah. So sometimes you don't need a full-on mentor. You could have someone who's had that specific experience,
like
new build developments,
or exactly,
accountancy advice around structures, etc.
I mean, you know, you look at anything in the property world, even just doing buy-to-lets, just refurbing them, refinancing them. Sometimes if you want to go quickly, you might want a mentor that can help you with investment from outside people, with builders, with how many projects to manage, with how to manage those projects and all that sort of stuff. So you can get some quick wins by paying somebody for their knowledge, for sure.
Yeah, okay, cool. And talking about wins and projects and stuff.
Yeah.
What's going on? Let's talk about the HMO.
Yeah.
The big one.
Let's
talk about the development, shall we? If you don't mind.
Because
you've built up a very successful portfolio and then you've taken on some bigger projects, and it'd be great to hear the journey of the HMO.
Yeah.
And then also what you're doing with the development stuff now as well.
If you've got all day. So trying to think. So we finished the development last year. So I've got some HMOs in Derby.
Yeah.
Only like some little six beds that I'd worked on with somebody before. They approached me with what effectively was a closed down care home.
Yeah.
And was like, do you want to convert this into a HMO? Really loved it. It was a step up into the next level. Mm. And it was something really to look at, full on development, full on, you know, having to go through the whole process to make it into something really special and really big.
Yeah.
So we put an offer in subject to planning in May. And I think from memory, that would have been 2018.
Yeah.
2018? Yes, would have been 2018. And went straight to planning, got an architect involved, got all, you know, planning consultant involved, went through the process, submitted for planning, which didn't get rejected, but went out to committee and got quite a lot of angry residents to complain and object against planning at this point.
As you do,
because they don't want a HMO on the street. Their idea of a HMO is that we're going to fill it with a lot of people that have problems or need social help or things like that. And that's not our market, but trying to get that message across to them, say, look, we do professional stuff, was very, very difficult. So they were very, very vocal about it. That basically dragged the planning out for the best part of 2 years. We didn't actually get to committee. We submitted the planning, I think, in September of 2018. We were forced to complete by the vendor in May of 2019.
Wow.
So we had a 50% bridging loan, 50% cash. We couldn't get any more because we didn't have planning on the building, so nobody would lend us any more money.
It's a risk.
So paying 600 grand plus stamp plus fees for it, we could only borrow 300 grand. So I had to put the rest of the money up for it to complete the purchase. The planning committee was the following week after we completed, and even the planning consultant was like, yeah, it'll pass. So it got deferred at the first planning committee meeting, and they asked us to reduce it from, I think it was 24 bedrooms down and come back with a smaller scheme. So we went back and we revised it down to 18.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're talking, these ensuite rooms are massive at this point anyway. It's a big old building. And it was four semi-detached houses that had all been extended over the years. Mm-hmm. So realistically, without knocking it all down and starting again, the use was very limited.
Yeah.
And the council knew that. The council was supportive of the application.
Mm-hmm.
It was just how vocal the residents were being to their local councillors and then the planning committee, as to the planning committee being nervous around it.
Yeah.
Fast forward quickly, we went back to committee in September where it got rejected of that year. So we had a rejected planning application, which is September 2019.
Mm-hmm.
So we went straight to appeal. So we took the whole planning, went straight to the planning inspectorate and put it in for appeal. In January 20, planning inspectorate rejected the planning as well, but for different reasons to the council. So the planning inspectorate basically said the reasons the council had given were invalid. They couldn't reject it based on those reasons. So that was a win in my book. I was like, okay, so they've thrown back at the council that's not a reason to reject the planning. The planning inspectorate picked up on the technicality that it's within 100 metres of the border of a flood zone for the River Trent. And for that, the planning inspectorate wanted some changes made so that we could basically, we had it configured as four flats.
Yeah.
So two ground floor, two first floor. And they were basically saying if there was a flood event, a 1-in-1,000-year flood event, the people on the ground floor had no escape to the first floor.
Got it. Yeah.
So we basically redesigned it into four houses so that each unit had an internal staircase.
Yeah.
So a bedroom on the ground floor, somebody can go upstairs if there's a flood event.
Yeah.
That was it. So we changed it around. But once we changed it around, we had to go back to the original planning through the council. During this time, COVID obviously came along in March of 20, and our bridging loan was up in May of 20. So I think at the beginning of May, we were still waiting for a new date for planning, having resubmitted the four house model rather than the four flats. At the beginning of May, the bridging lender phoned up and sort of started going, we want our money back.
Find some pressure.
Okay. Well, I don't know what you want me to do about this. I don't have 300 grand in the bank.
Yeah.
We haven't got planning yet, but we are going back in. The date for the planning meeting was after the end of the bridging loan.
Yeah.
So technically, we should have had to have given it back or done something with it. To which they just sort of said, well, that's not our problem. You need to get it refinanced, you know. So called around a few brokers, bearing in mind we're still in lockdown at this point. Nobody's been allowed out. Nobody's really going to site to do surveys, to get valuations.
Yeah.
Nobody's really sure what's happening. So, of course, a building with no planning, no new lender's going to take it on. And that was obvious.
Especially in the
beginning of COVID.
Yeah.
And that was very obvious very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So that presented some challenges for us. And we spent most of May 20 sort of fighting with the bridging lender directly to try and just get an extension.
Yeah.
To which they finally agreed, but obviously at a cost, a very significant cost for a 6-month extension, which was just unfortunate, but didn't have any choice, had nowhere else to turn really at that point to actually get that sorted. Because of COVID, the planning meeting got cancelled in May or just after May. So it didn't come to committee again until July of 20. One thing that worked in our favour during COVID, though, for the planning is that they'd moved all the planning meetings online via Teams, so the public could not have an open opinion in a planning committee room.
Yeah.
So when we've been to, I mean, going to the planning committee meetings before, we've been booed by the residents, we've been shouted at. Being the only person in there with a planning consultant and realising the other 50 people are there to object against what you're going to go and talk about is horrendous.
Oh, gosh.
And just mentally scarring.
I was going to say, like, how's your mental like well-being with all this going on? Like, on the Bridge and Loan, delays, COVID?
Did
you think of selling it? Or did you, like, what?
We put it on the market.
I went down
that route.
Yeah.
But people were offering significantly less than we paid for it at this point because we'd had a failed planning application against it.
Yeah.
So that, I knew that presented a real challenge. Mm. There were points where I was about to accept a couple of offers and probably take $100,000 loss on it just to walk away.
Yeah.
Especially when the bridging lenders started getting funny and really started putting the screws on. Bearing in mind, I'm in a place where I'm trying to work with some of my IT clients to deliver the best for them during a really difficult period for them. Mm. You're then under pressure from something that is still slightly outside of your control, but is your responsibility. Yeah. The 3 years end to end until we actually got it through planning. There were sleepless nights. There were worries. It's the one project I actually sat and looked at Chris at one point and said, you know, this could take us bankrupt.
Yeah.
We have to sit here and be realistic. Yeah. Like, do we sell our house to pay the money off?
Yeah.
You know, where do you find $300,000?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when the markets are difficult anyway.
And this is the reality of taking on bigger projects, the market changes, things aren't on your side like planning.
Yeah.
And I think it's good. Thank you for sharing this, because a lot of people always talk about, you know, the wins and the fluffy stuff, but actually the sleepless nights, the anxiety, the pressure, the stress. You've got investors' commitment, you've got the bridge and loan companies. We've seen what they were like in COVID. Some of those, very few that were very helpful. Some of them turned into, you know, they're quite aggressive and there was a lot of negotiations going on. We've got some negotiations we're doing ourselves now to try and, you know, help them see common sense.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, there's not much common sense when it comes to, it's not common, right? That's the thing.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's it. I think it was a difficult time. Nobody knew what was going to happen. So, of course, if you're sat on a business that is making money, but you're lending, you want to try and bring some of that back in. One, so you've got some of your own cash sat in the bank, but two, you've got to protect your business.
Absolutely.
So I get where they were coming from, but I mean, the conversation with the lending manager, I think one day I was just like, well, just I'll send you the keys, you can have the building.
Yeah.
She sort of stuttered and was really like, and I was like, yeah, because you don't know what to do with it either.
Yeah. What can you
don't want to end up with it because you know you can't sell it. You know you can't get planning on it at the moment.
Yeah.
So you either give me the extension, let me deal with it, for which I'm going to pay you more money. You're still making money.
Yeah.
Or you take it and you deal with it.
That trust in me. Yeah. That's what I was trying to explain to them. Look, these people, it's not, they haven't deliberately gone out their way to fail or not deliver a project. They still want to do it. You've got to believe in them, because if you do and show that support and have a bit of patience, then if there's a successful end result and you've supported them, they'll come back around to you. But if you don't, you'll lose a client, and you'll probably lose 10 more potential clients, because they will speak to whoever about their experience. And I've tried to explain to so many lenders like this, you know, it's really important to, you're in this game, you know, don't close the doors too quickly.
It is interesting because obviously I had a bad experience with that lender. Somebody else has had a really good experience with them, so it's difficult. And then I refinanced it once we got planning. I refinanced it to another lender that then lent us money for the development. And I had a really good experience with them, and somebody else had a really bad experience with them. You just think, where do you draw the line?
I think sometimes it is case by case and markets and what's going on. And I also say this to the clients, there's different funding lines.
Yeah.
So like one in these short-term lenders, like there could be a funding line that, you know, we want 10% return, we want A credit clients, we want at least 5 projects under belt. Whereas another funding line would be like, we want 4% return, we want we're happy with commercial, we're happy with mixed use, and happy with their first project. And it's like, so depending on that money comes in, you'll see flexibility. But the lenders, I don't really think they convey that, because they always want you to think it's their money. But that's maybe a little insight. All right, so good news, you got planning.
Yeah, so July 20, we got planning. So that was a massive win. Caused another sleepless night just through excitement and just like the relief, of 2 years and just like kind of thinking, you know, I kind of had to stop for a couple of days and go, right, we've got planning. Seriously, what do we do now, though? Yeah. Do we carry on? Do we try and sell it with planning? Do we exit? You know, where are we? So we used the rest of the time we had on that bridging loan extension to get it refinanced. So we managed, because we had planning then, we could get it refinanced. We managed to get the money for the development. So I decided that we take it through and develop it. So builder started in January 21.
Yeah.
And finished in September of last year.
And what was the end value, if you don't mind me asking?
So the end valuation that we got mortgaged against was 1.4 million. Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Considering we paid 600 for the building.
Yeah.
We spent just over 400 on it.
Yeah.
In total. So
an uplift of 400 or so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was worth it, don't get me wrong, but 4 years of my life that I can't get back. I did have hair when I started. I think...
But it just shows how tenacious you are as a person and your capability. And I think for investors listening, it just demonstrates not that you need any more investors, how investable you are. You know, I think
we still work with new investors just because I think, you know, some of the older ones that we've used before sometimes go off and do different things.
Yeah,
so we kind of, if somebody's looking to make some money and we've got a decent project, we'll look at it. But I do think, for me, again, it comes back to what we were saying at the beginning. It's all about communication. It's all about how you deal with it.
Yeah.
I think mentally, even managing an IT department for a hedge fund, the 4 years with the care home, bearing in mind I was working full time, it's not on my doorstep. So for planning meetings, it was a 6-hour round trip.
Yeah.
You know, you're having to take time to go and do that. You're having to be on site. You're having to go and see the council. Like you say, you're having to have phone calls and meetings with bridging lenders. You've got to factor all that into it.
Yeah.
And it was really tough. It was exhausting. I wouldn't wish a project like that on nearly anybody. But I do feel like I've come out of it the other side, and I do look at projects very, very differently now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, congratulations of coming out the other side.
Thank you.
And it's all learning, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you didn't go bankrupt. You
know, we made it.
You made money on it. So well done. And it's all let, right?
Isn't yeah, it? Yeah. It's fully let. So, I mean, it brings in about 12 and a half grand a month gross.
Yeah.
So obviously not being financed really good, but the quality we put into it, you know, we broke all the ceilings for shared housing in the area.
Yeah.
Because we didn't just make it one great big 18 bed HMO. In the end, we've split it down into four units. It feels more individual. Mm. So you've got that little bit more of a community in each house.
Yeah, I think that's quite important. I think when I was a student in Cardiff, you looked at some of the HMOs and you thought it'd be a good idea to have like a 12 bed HMO. And then there's like 11 boys in there running around. It's an absolute mess. I don't really like living there anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but actually having the smaller kind of units it seems a bit more.
Especially once you move past the student market into the young professional market, definitely the smaller units are better. Yeah,
and a bit more intimate in terms of getting to know each other rather than who's on the third floor and
See them popping in and out. And you don't really know who you're living with.
Nicking my milk.
Exactly that. Yeah.
Okay, fine. I'm conscious of time.
Yeah.
Briefly just give us an insight to the development in terms of what you're doing with it at the moment. So you've moved into new build.
So secured a piece of land.
Yeah.
Basically went through the same process. So architect, planning. Mm. We got planning for eight new build houses, all detached to go on that site.
Amazing.
So four beds, three bed bungalow and three story townhouses, three bedroom jobs at the back of the site. Again, we've had challenges, COVID times, that prices have gone through the roof. Yeah. We had a builder assessing the project for 6 months, keen to start, all geared up to start last September, and then they pulled out at the last minute. So we had to go back out and re-tender, refund builder, refund some other elements to that. So that's underway at the moment.
Has that been on like a fixed contract with the builders, or is it kind of...
It was fixed, But we allowed them to build in quite a lot of fat.
Okay.
There were some, you know, there was some future planning that prices would go up more in that fixed price, because we can all see that they are just going up and still going up. And then, you know, for us, it was about having a sensible conversation with them to say, look, it is fixed price, but we're really not going to mess you around. We don't want you going bankrupt.
Yeah.
Because that's no good to us either.
Yeah.
So, like, you have to come back to the table. If prices jump by more than X, let's revisit it. Let's see what that price looks like.
Yeah, so that communication again, let's be honest.
And
let's not try and put all over each other.
Because equally, house prices are going up.
Mm.
So we're going to get more out the back end, so we can afford to, you know, if prices do go up significantly, rather than you being pinned against the wall, let's meet some of this together.
Yeah.
you know, sense. When you have to, and if you've got a good build team there, I think they'll appreciate that.
Happy days.
But yeah, so they should, the first four are due for completion in September, late September.
Okay,
so they'll be on the market then, yeah. With the back four on the site being slightly behind that. So I expect those to go on the market in January.
Wow. And then after that, more new builds or more holidays?
Yeah, more holidays. I think just because obviously alongside that, I'm looking at these three other projects. We've got these two buildings in legals at the moment that we're looking to do high-end service accommodation with.
Yeah.
If we start getting the returns from those that I expect, then yeah, we probably will. I really do just want to take a year where I just go, I'm not going to buy anything. Everything just needs to run.
Yeah.
Because I think with the care home taking so long, you know, I delivered other projects alongside that. Yeah. We did a grade two listed 15 bed HMO that took 12 months, you know, end to end. Whereas, you know,
when something... do you enjoy the fruits of the labor?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. When do you just sit back and go, actually, let's not buy anything, let's not develop anything, let's just stop and go, let everything come in for a year and see where you are at the end of it?
I think it's important because I was saying that to my business partner, Paul, on in the property business, and I think we've done several buy to let refurbs and a commercial. Yeah. And I thought, that's nice that the portfolio is where it is. There's income coming in. And, and I'm thinking, right, let's when we haven't touched the income, me and Paul, so let's have a meeting and talk about it. He's like, oh, I've got another project over here. I'm looking at now. We've got two more over there. And I'm thinking, here we go again.
Yeah. It's just constant. It is just constant. But yeah, I think if we get through these, I just need to sit back, let the new build site sell. The other house that's next to the new build site that we're splitting into a pair of semis to sell as well. Get all of that done.
Yeah.
See what's in the bank. And then move
take
on
stock,
again.
Take stock, isn't it?
Yeah.
Take stock, regroup, and move from a position of power, I guess, or a position of, like, a bit more comfortable. You've taken some time to...
It's that position of a war chest, I think. You know, we'll have been going solidly for, like, 6 years without a break.
Yeah.
We're constant development for 6 years. And, again, as you said, that it builds you mentally. Mm. I mean, I feel like I could deal with a lot if it was thrown at me.
Yeah.
But I think there is a point where you do just have to go, right, let's take 10 to 12 months and not put ourselves in that situation where we're having to think about projects, having to manage builders, having to call solicitors all the time, and just step back
and just enjoy it and listen to everyone else talking about
everybody else,
keep going, it's all right.
And just go, I don't ever want another project.
And just outside of work, Alan, CrossFit, it's quite you're still doing CrossFit? Yeah. You're enjoying it?
I still absolutely love it. So I was kind of into it just before COVID, and then obviously everything shut down. But since April last year, when the gyms could reopen after COVID, I've been, you know, every week that I'm here, I'll go to our local CrossFit gym several times a week.
No, I've been trying a little bit of CrossFit and it's intense, but afterwards I feel amazing. In the moment, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be sick.
Yeah, I'm going to die. Absolutely.
But, you know, machines, like literally, and a great community, I found people. Like, no judgment, just come and go, no egos. It's just train hard, support each other, and, you know, get good well-being, good health.
Absolutely. If you find the right box, you'll get the right community. And the people local to me in Calm, where I go, is like a 10-minute drive from the house. It's brilliant.
Good and
bunch. It is about the community. Absolutely.
And you meet people that are older there, they're way fitter than you. I really need to up my game.
I mean, I look at, there's a couple of guys that are 60 and some of the movements they can do that I can't, and I'm like, hang on a minute, I'm 20 years younger than you. I should be able to do this easily. And
there
you just can't. I might still be able to move in that time.
Do you think the fitness helps with like your mental well-being and also the day-to-day of like the IT consultancy business and the property stuff? If without the fitness, do you think you'd see a lag in performance?
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Just probably for me, mostly through mental clarity. I think if I look back at the years towards the end when I was managing the department at Hedge Fund during the care home, I didn't look after myself as well as I should have done. And once your fitness drops, your food quality drops and you have more takeaways and you might not necessarily put as much effort into it. And actually all of that just builds and you are tired, you're fatigued, you know, you become sluggish, you can't think properly. And I really find like, you know, having weekends where you don't drink and you wake up on a Monday morning feeling fresh, you just eat good food, you go for a load of runs, you go to CrossFit. I mean, the last few weeks I've been going to 6-7 sessions a week.
Wow.
And yes, I don't go on Saturdays and Sundays, but I'll go running and I'll do other stuff, but I feel great.
Yeah.
Like I'm alive. I get up at 4:45 in the morning to sort the dogs out before I start work, go to the gym, like... You feel amazing for it.
And that compounds, doesn't it?
Right? Yeah.
So if you know the people that drink on a Saturday, Sunday, or Friday, Saturday, how they're feeling on a Sunday, not very good, the anxiety on Monday, I haven't done this, I've got to be washing, and that kind of compounds in the wrong direction. And me and Dean was talking about it, like the benefits of compounding in the right direction versus the wrong direction.
Yeah.
I was just taking on a new PT at the gym around the corner, and I've been working with him, and he's been amazing.
Yeah.
XRAF, really motivated. The problem I've got is I must be too good at recruiting because now I've got him to join.
He's still going to be a mortgage broker.
Yeah, because his partner's having a child and he wants a different career direction.
Yeah.
I told him what we do, and
yeah,
he come over and met the team. He's like, I love it. And, you know, he's really motivated. We think we can give him a good opportunity. But are you still going to PT me now?
Or? Yeah.
Because I feel the same, like that mental clarity,
yeah,
keeping fit. And I, you know, wanted to bring it up because anyone kind of sitting on the sofa and wanting to be in business property, but feeling a bit tired and, you know, maybe just get up, move,
yeah,
get your health and fitness right, well-being, and then you'll
yeah, and remember, you're not going to go out and run a marathon tomorrow.
No,
like it's taken me. If you look at some of the CrossFit competitions, I mean, I'm still nowhere near some of the RX weights and things that when you start looking at them. But if I look back to last April when I started, I'm way further ahead of when I was then.
We talk about Will, who's doing the recording here. We talk about 1% gains in the business. How do we make the business 1% better? You know, even just having like a credit card machine or different whiteboards or different IT tech. Do you know, them little, like, can we record our phone calls so we can listen back and see how we performed and spoke to clients? All this stuff just doing improve. As long as we're doing that 1%, so we, you know, we look back to, you know, 3.5 years ago, I was in my spare bedroom.
It's like literally
me and a whiteboard and my mobile. And so you've got to reflect on that and, you know, take some pride in yourself and what you've achieved, right?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Awesome. Alan, you've been amazing. There's loads of value in there. I've learned a lot.
I could sit here and talk for hours.
I know, we could. I'm going to sort my diary out. That's what I'm going to do.
Send me a screenshot of it later.
I will do. I actually am going to do it. And yeah, because it's really helpful. But no, thank you so much for your time. I know you're busy.
Yeah, brilliant.
But appreciate you coming down. And,
no, thanks.
Hopefully we'll get you back on maybe towards maybe next year when you're doing nothing.
Yeah,
and chilling
hopefully.
Out and ask us what it's like. Well, no, it'd be great to hear about the projects, the development, how that unfolded, and maybe do a bit of a
case study on it. Be awesome.
Right. Thank you.
Brilliant.
Thanks so much for listening, guys.